How do you like your grits?
My name is Ben Blanton, and I'm from Tucker, Georgia. I prefer my grits the savory style with salt and maybe cheese. I have had sugar grits before, but not one of my favorites.
My name is Venus Prather, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I take my grits with butter and black pepper.
Would you ever consider doing sugar?
No, this don't taste good. No, sugar go in cereal. Grits are not cereal.
Sweet, salty, buttery, cheesy. How you flavor this dish calls into question your taste and also your Southern identity. Here to talk about the history of grits, in the South at least, is Virginia Willis. She's a chef and cookbook author, and she has written an entire book on grits. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So what is a grit?
Grits are ground corn.
And that's it?
That's it.
Okay. So what makes a grit different from, say, oatmeal in terms of the way we cook them?
There's really not that much difference in terms of cooking. Of course, oatmeal would be made from oats, but both are grains or whole grains.
And they're boiled?
And they're boiled or simmered.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So can we just talk about, first of all, why people are so emotional about this? I mean, I realize that food is an emotional topic, but I'm looking at the title of a blog somebody wrote on this issue, and the title is "Why People Who Like Sugar on Grits Should Be on the Terrorist Watch List."
I guess she thinks grits are pretty serious business.
Yeah. So why? Have you encountered this?
Well, I think the thing about grits is that as a Southerner, it's so much part of our identity, and food is so much part of identities and for people in general. And then I think that in the South, food is so very important. It really does just sort of tap into things. But I'm not certain I'm not that familiar with the sugary grits.
You aren't?
No.
So you've never eaten sugary grits?
No. No. I would say that that's more of a not Southern thing, perhaps more of a Northern thing.
Well, I have one of our own, Josephine Bennett, says, "When I moved here in 1991, I thought they were the same thing as cream of wheat. Of course, now I know the difference and love them with salt, pepper, butter, and always homemade."
Yes.
So it's possible that if someone does confuse them with, say, an oatmeal or cream of wheat, that they'd put brown sugar in it.
Yeah, for sure.
But why is that not good?
Oh, I don't think it's not good. It's a personal preference. So a traditional Southern way of cooking grits would be, you know, simmering them in water, and then adding butter or salt and pepper at the end. And then there's, you know, the other things like cheese or garlic or things like that. I think that at the basis, if you think about grits, that it's like it's poor people food, right? It's ground corn.
Right, because it's so cheap.
It's so cheap. So sugar would have been expensive. So in the beginning, for certain, it wouldn't have been traditional to have sugar because sugar would have been more expensive than the ground corn.
So when I here's another comment. When I said we're going to settle the great grit debate, a friend of mine from Brooklyn says, by making hash browns, how did...
Oh, that's sad.
I know. So, but how did grits become such a Southern staple?
So corn grows very well in the South. It grows on the coastal South, the deep South, the Appalachian South. It grows all throughout. And it's a wonderful crop in that it grows and can be harvested for months at a time. So when corn is growing in the field in the summer, it can be harvested as long as the corn is being produced off the stalks. And then at the end of the season, when it's getting towards the end of summer, when it's getting towards fall, the corn can remain on the stalk, dry on the stalk, and then it's ground. The kernels would be then ground for cornmeal and for grits that would be eaten in the wintertime.
And they last for a really long time.
And it lasts, yeah. So it's a very sustaining grain. It can be eaten fresh in the summer and then throughout the year. So the South has always been a very poor region, so we were perfectly set up to become grits lovers.
How did grits sort of enter our cookbooks, at least? Was it usually used alone? In other words, that it's the main side dish? Or did people start using grits in other recipes?
Well, I think in the beginning, you know, going back to the fact that it's like it's poor people food, it's gruel. It's, you know, gruel in Scotland is oatmeal, gruel in Asia is rice, gruel, you know, I mean, there's...
Oh, gruel is not a specific thing.
No, it's like a porridge.
Right.
A soupy grain. So in terms of in the beginning, I would imagine that grits were simply served plain, cooked with water and salt and pepper, perhaps, and that's it. Yeah, and then
it needs at least some pepper,
right? And then I think that, you know, if you just think about it, so you have this carbohydrate, and then someone's having a piece of cheese for breakfast at the same time, or lunch, or whatever it may be, and because the cheese is the protein, and then there's like a little happy marriage, and it's like, wow, that cheese tastes great in my grits,
and it does,
right? So, and then in terms of becoming more popular, you know, people just started realizing that it's sort of this like wide open canvas that you could put other things into.
So on Twitter, right now we have a poll going. There are zero votes for sugar in our grits debate Twitter poll. Salt has 100% of the vote. If you're just joining us, my guest is chef and cookbook author Virginia Willis. I am holding in my hand Grits by Virginia Willis, so she literally wrote the book. Fred Burton on Twitter does not believe there can be all that many people who actually sugar their grits. He tweets, just a few renegades, hashtag no sugar on grits. And Kenneth Gibbs tweets, he takes his grits with salt, pepper, butter, cheese optional, sharp cheddar, or Parmesan. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to read you this thing from Amy Condon down in Savannah, who says sometimes she puts grilled onions and crumbles of turkey sausage into her grits.
Oh, I love Amy.
Well.
She's a good friend of mine. That's awesome.
Well, there you go.
Small world. Yeah.
I know. So what, I mean, grits, because they're just a grain, they can basically be the background for almost anything you add.
Definitely. So I often serve grits for supper. I don't cook them for breakfast because the grits that I use are stone ground grits that, not like Joe Pesci was talking about in the clip in the beginning.
Instant grits.
15-minute grits. That's practically a quick grit. So stone ground grits are going to take 45 minutes to 60 minutes to simmer. So
Really stone ground?
Yeah, they really are.
Like with stones?
Like with stones, hence the term stone ground. They're two giant wheels that are made most often of granite, and they have sort of ridges, and they rotate in opposite directions, and it
crushes them. Why is that better?
Well, the stone ground grits are whole grain. That's the part that I think is so exciting, because everyone assumes that Southern food is unhealthy, mm-hmm. and grits in and of themselves are not unhealthy. If they're whole grain, we all know how whole grains are good for us. So it has bran, it has the fiber, it has heart-healthy fats, all of these things. So stone ground or whole grain, and then depending on what you cook them in, you can cook them in water, you cook them with stock, you could cook them with milk. There are many different things. That will, of course, affect it. But they're this sort of wide open. You can cook them with onions or sausage or add. I cook them and I'll add sautéed collard greens or sautéed spinach. It's delicious.
And you call yourself a grits missionary.
I am a grits missionary for sure.
What does that mean?
Well, I always say that if you don't like grits and the only grits you've ever had involve a microwave and a cup, of course you don't like grits because you've not really had the real thing.
You're speaking to our producer, Sean Powers.
Yeah, that's not real.
Yeah.
It's whole grains are delicious and good for you. Quick grits and instant grits, they remove the bran, they remove the germs.
Because that would take longer to cook.
Well, it's because they contain fats that are not shelf stable, and so they'll go rancid. So they take, they take all the good out of the corn, and all that's left is starch. And then that starch is cooked and spread out in great big sheets and dried and then reground. So it's like all the soul has left the corn, and it tastes like paste.
Yeah.
If one would eat paste.
You might even be able to make paste.
Yeah.
With them.
Yeah. So real stone ground, whole grain corn, if you cook it plain in water, you can really, you can taste the corn.
Do you eat oatmeal?
I do eat oatmeal.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, do you use it the same way, but you prefer grits?
No, well, it's like apples and oranges. I like both fruits, right? So
okay.
they're completely different. Used for different things. Yeah. I do the overnight oatmeal that's so popular now because it's a quick, easy
in the
breakfast.
Mason jar,
yeah, exactly. And it's like easy to fix. I most often prefer grits for supper or for brunch when there's a little bit more time because, you know, I'm a busy person and getting up in the morning and cooking grits for an hour isn't on my list of things to do.
Okay, so we got another one that says, Robbie Medwed says, I often make grit cakes. I treat it the same as polenta. You advise, you're nodding your head. That's advised?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's nice. Polenta and grits are practically the same thing. They're both ground corn.
Okay. And then we have one from Sam Burnham who says, grits go best with fried fish and hush puppies. So it sounds like he agrees with you that they're more of a lunch or dinner.
Yeah. And there's a tradition with that, though, because fried fish is, of course, most often coated in cornmeal. And cornmeal and grits, there's a fine line literally between them because it's just the size of the
one's ground more.
Exactly.
Okay, and last tweet here, Catherine Napkina writes, oh, this is on Facebook, I don't care for sugar on my French fries or rice. I don't care for ketchup on my eggs. I prefer grits with shrimp. I prefer oatmeal with butter, but I think food preferences are just preferences. And that's kind of what it comes down to,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, and it's there are cultural reasons.
Yeah, if you're in the South, it looks like you're going to put salt and butter on your grits. Virginia Willis is a chef and cookbook author. Virginia, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The band Little Tybee first came together in Atlanta in 2009. The group is hard to label. They blend some folk, some jazz, and a lot of really intricate musical arrangements. Little Tybee releases its fourth album this week, and they're here to give us a preview. This is all part of our year-long celebration of Georgia music. Little Tybee is Brock Scott on guitar and vocals, Josh Martin on guitar, Nirvana Kelly on violin, Ryan Donald on electric bass, Pat Brooks on drums, and Chris Case on keyboard. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
It sounds from the way you've described your process as relatively collaborative. How do you make that work between six people?
Generally speaking, I guess I'll usually come up with, you know, a part acoustically, and it always starts out as kind of like a delicate menagerie, and I'll bring it to the band, and they're able to kind of add some intricate sprinkles to it that really kind of turn it into more of a beautiful composition.
Nirvana, do you think of this as a real collaboration?
I do think so. So generally, Brock does bring us the song and sort of a melody and some sort of chord progression, but a lot of times I feel like Chris Case and Josh Martin really start to explore and flesh out, I guess, these what can happen musically. So I feel like it's collaborative. It does lead with Brock, but we all get the song, we work together on it, and it just sort of it fleshes itself out. And I think we've played with each other for so long now that we really know where someone's going to go, what someone's going to do.
And do you work from printed music? Do you have chord sheets?
No printed music. At least I don't have any printed music.
It's all just memorized and rehearsed and rehearsed. And things really start to flush themselves out when we tour them on the road for, you know, 40 dates back to back. That's when the songs really kind of bloom into, you know, what they inevitably become.
All right, so let's hear some music. What's the first piece you're going to play for us?
This song we're about to play is called Loaves of Bread.
Is it in danger? Never seen one before. Grab a hammer and board up the door. All it would take is a whisper, and you'll know we were here and tear us from ear to ear. Maybe it's a dark place, lost a soul or maybe a stray. Thank you.
That's the band Little Tybee with the song Loaves of Bread. It's off their new album. They're with me here today in GPB's Performance Space. And this new album is crowdfunded.
Correct.
So why did you choose to go that way? You went on Kickstarter.
Correct. We've released, you know, albums with record labels, and I think there's nothing wrong with working with record labels, but just from our experience, you know, this being our fourth studio album, we just really thought it was important to maintain control of your music and ownership of your music.
A lot of musicians aren't the best business managers in the world, aren't the best promotions managers, for example. A lot of those things that a record company takes care of, you might think that it would free you up to focus more on the music. So how has that balance been since you were doing it on your own?
You're able to reach a really broad and wide audience with the internet that I think was a lot harder before. So there's a lot more power that today's artists are able to have. And one thing that I think is interesting is that most bands don't realize that they are a brand. And I think that if a lot of the same tactics that a band uses as promotion are the same things that like a corporation would use. It's marketing, it's branding, it's advertising, like all of these things. But the only difference is that a band is already cool. You know, you think about like corporations and they need to hire artists and musicians to like tie that cool factor onto them, you know? So bands just work backwards in that you are already a cool brand. Now you just need to sell stuff. So if you can figure out...
Unless you're like a polka band.
There's a market for the polka band too. I think you can get some like suspenders.
Just talking about like the cool factor may not be present. But let me ask you about the touring process, Nirvana, because... Very often, tours can do a band in, right? You are usually sitting right next to each other for mile after mile after mile in a car, right? What's touring like for you guys?
So for our band, touring is a very close bonding experience. We sit very close to each other in the van at this point, but we've actually done rides in the past, like around, I think, the year 2011 in a 1998 Subaru Forester.
Six people in there?
It was five at the time.
Five people at the time.
Still too much.
It was still too much to be in one vehicle. There
was all
five
your gear
of us.
In a
yes.
trailer or something?
No. We had a turtle on top, and we had...
it was awful.
All of the gear
I don't
was
know if
actually...
Josh, people can hear Josh saying that it was awful. But...
Yeah, it was.
It was interesting that...
But there was no trailer. It was just our gear literally on top of us in the tiny little trunk portion
Holy
and on
cow.
A turtle. And we actually rode all the way to Canada. Actually, we also drove from Montreal to Atlanta.
20 hours
in that setup. So we've really upgraded our touring abilities. Now we have a van.
Big Blue.
Big blue van that
nice.
Which
has
means
more
you probably
space.
All get along better.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
But honestly, we really get along pretty well on the road. I would say that very few, if any, issues would come up.
So let's hear something else. What else? You're going to play something else from the new album.
Yeah, this next song is called Tuck My Tail.
Bags to leave.
We're with the band Little Tybee in GPB's performance space, and we just heard the song Tuck My Tail. Before we go, the old-timey retro radio is on your new album. What's the deal with the radios?
So we were trying to come up with like a cool kind of marketing PR thing for this album that wasn't too gimmicky. And I had the idea of mailing these old radios around the world and then having different videographers film them in different locations while playing the album through it. And there's lights on this radio that interact with the music as it's playing through it. So it's kind of this cool little visualizer. You can find out more about it.
Sorry. How many radios did you end up having to get?
So we have 10 radios floating around the world right now, and every morning I wake up and I look on eBay, and I look specifically for the General Electric P975F series radio, and I've actually become a member of a lot of transistor radio forums, and I never thought I would be a member of transistor radio forums, but it's actually a very cool hobby, I would say, if anyone's interested in transistor radios.
And you can get more at the website for the band. They can see the radios around the world, right?
LittleTybee.com. You can see some stuff.
That is Brock Scott, and you also heard from Nirvana Kelly of the band Little Tybee. The group releases its fourth album this week. The other members are guitarist Josh Martin, Ryan Donald on electric bass, Pat Brooks on drums, and Chris Case on the keyboards. Thank you guys all so much. You're going to play us out with something?
Yes, we are going to play a song off our new record, and it's called Languid.
To see videos of Little Tybee performing in our studio, visit gpbnews.org. Coming up, time to open up the gripe bag on stadium construction in Metro Atlanta. This is On Second Thought. Well, the Atlanta Braves will make history this year. Unfortunately, it's because it looks like they're headed for one of the worst seasons in the franchise's history. Next year, maybe the team will get a fresh start in their fresh new stadium in Cobb County. The Braves' move, though, has been plagued with problems from the very beginning. Millions of dollars have been tacked on to the initial cost of construction, and it looks like several key pieces of infrastructure may not be ready when the stadium opens. Another wrinkle is traffic. Traffic is already pretty bad in Cobb County, so how much worse will it be once SunTrust Park opens next year? Dan Kleppel has some ideas about that. He's a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good to have you back, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Angie Schmidt. She's the editor of Streets Blog USA. Hi there, Angie.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Dan, what were the plans originally? I mean, they must have made plans to try to make sure that traffic congestion did not get bad around the stadium.
Well, it already is bad, as you mentioned.
Okay, and worse?
Yes. Well, and for sold-out games, the estimate is that an additional 20,000 cars will be on the road. The Braves and the county say that there are a few things that will help mitigate the traffic. One is that there is 14 points of access into the stadium development. Another is technology. There will be apps that fans can have that will show them the best route to the stadium and where to park, where available parking is. And they also say that the mixed-use development that the Braves are building outside the stadium will cause fans to arrive early and stay late after games are over, and that will help mitigate traffic. I mean, there's truth in all of that. There's also flaws in the argument. On a Wednesday night game, it's hard to imagine that fans coming from work will get there early.
Yeah.
And if they have to get up for work the next morning, it's hard to imagine that they'll stay late. And those 14 points of access, that's true, there are 14 points of access, but there's only 2 points of access to the 14 points off the interstate. And so there are going to be choke points.
Okay. What happened to the pedestrian bridge, and why is that going to make it worse?
Well, I don't know that it will make it worse. The bridge has been a part of the stadium plan from the beginning. In fact, the county announced the plan to build the bridge the day after the Braves announced their move. So it's been hand in glove, part of the plan from the very beginning. The cost of the bridge has been unclear from the beginning. Now we know construction is almost $11 million. There's another $1 million for the design of the bridge. And they still have to buy right-of-way or land that they need to build the bridge. And that cost is unknown. So the cost is more than was originally determined. And it's not going to be open to the shuttle tram that they're going to have to carry fans from hotels and distant parking to the ballpark. Originally, the plan was to have these buses go over the bridge and out of the main traffic jams around the stadium to keep them free of the traffic. And the bridge isn't going to be ready for those buses for the first year at least.
Which implies that's going to make things worse.
Well, the buses will be in traffic with everybody else, right?
Angie, is there if you're going to have thousands of people, perhaps tens of thousands, coming in to a stadium, can you do that without having major traffic headaches?
This is a little bit of an unusual case. I mean, usually stadiums are in cities that are sort of set up to be multimodal, to be walkable, to
What does multimodal mean, Angie?
To have multiple forms of transportation that provide access. So when it was more in the downtown area, people could use MARTA. And although MARTA access wasn't that great, some people did use MARTA to get to the games. But this stadium is located in more of a suburban area. Almost everyone's going to have to arrive by car. And that presents a lot of problems. It requires a lot of infrastructure because cars sort of take up a lot of space. So that means they're going to need to have a lot of parking, and there may not be enough road space already in place to accommodate those kind of crowds.
Dan, is it too late to talk about the possibility of mass transit going to the stadium so that you don't have to have 20,000 cars?
Well, Cobb County has been traditionally resistant to MARTA expansion into Cobb. If you want to take mass transit to the ballpark, if you're south, what you'll have to do is take MARTA to the Arts Center station and get on a bus. They have a Route 10X bus that will take you to the stadium, but that's going to be in traffic with everybody else.
Yeah, and also without traffic, it takes over an hour to do that. I've looked, because I live in Marietta,
right.
And that's not really a realistic
the mass transit plan at this point.
And there's no possibility, as far as you know, of it opening that debate being reopened.
I wouldn't say that. I would never say never, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, and certainly not in time for 2017.
So, Angie, how are we, not just Metro Atlantans, but everybody in Georgia, because people do come from around the state to go, how do we deal with this? What can we do?
Well, I think people are going to think this sounds crazy, but one thing that you could do, I think, is take a lane of the highway during the games and make it bus only. If you're going to be transporting all these people by these circulator buses from nearby, give them a jump ahead of traffic. That will encourage less people to drive. You have to sort of encourage less people to drive if you're going to fit so many people in such a confined area. Another thing that they could do along the same lines is just charge for parking or charge more for parking. Potentially that will get more people carpooling, considering taking transit, maybe biking. I don't think it's a very safe area for biking, so you probably won't see a lot of that. But
If we'd love to hear from all of you out there, how do you feel about the Braves' move to Cobb County? We sent our production assistants out into Atlanta to ask that question.
My name is Venus Prather, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm kind of disappointed because they've been in Summerhill for all this time, and the neighborhood has really went down. since they decided to move to Cobb County. So I'm kind of disappointed about that. Yeah, and I know the neighbors are. I know they are.
Vicki Van Buren, and I'm from here, Atlanta. Well, I think it was kind of sneaky, to be honest with you. I don't really know if I know all the details behind it, but I don't really care for the area where they're moving to. It's already congested beyond belief, and I kind of feel like there might have been some things going on that the general public was not made aware of until it was too late. So I really think they should stay in Atlanta.
We would love you to join this conversation. You can do that on Twitter. Victor Walters tweets that the construction of the new stadium, honestly, it is making me look for a new home. My guests are AJC reporter Dan Kleppel and blogger Angie Schmidt. We're talking about the new Braves Stadium in Cobb County and the effects it may have on the surrounding area. Dan, who's involved in considering solutions to this?
Well, one of the big missing puzzle pieces right now is the Braves parking plan. They're going to announce that later this summer. And that's going to have a tremendous effect on traffic patterns. And so we just don't know what the plan is for parking at this point. And, you know, we're less than a year out. So the Braves say that's coming. So certainly the Braves and their parking plan is a big piece of that.
Do we even have any idea how much land they've purchased for the purpose of parking?
Well, we know how much land they purchased, but for parking, it's unclear exactly what their plan is. They're going to announce it. And the county is also involved because they will be responsible, for the police officers and that sort of thing outside directing traffic. So it's a partnership between the Braves and the county.
Wait, who pays for all the police officers outside directing traffic?
The Braves will have security inside the stadium. I believe they fund that, and I believe it's the county's responsibility outside for the most part.
Angie, what are you most concerned about with, I mean, you write about streets. That's what you do. What are you most concerned about here?
Well, I think everyone's concern is sort of the same, is that there's already this terrible traffic at the nexus of these two huge highways, and that it's going to get worse, and that I don't know. It's interesting. I haven't seen a case like this before, so it'll be interesting to see.
What do you mean you haven't seen a case like this before?
Well, it's like I said, it's unusual to see these in a suburban area as opposed to an urban area.
Oh, I see.
An area that's so exclusively sort of a drive-to place. And also, it's also not sort of, I think it would be a little bit better if it was in a more rural area. If it was in an area that wasn't so developed, then they could build, acres and acres of parking and it would be no problem. So this is a little bit of the worst of both worlds, if you ask me.
We have a tweet from Edward Austin Hall who says, not bitter here, but the only food allowed at Braves and Cobb should be grits with sugar. Dan, are we supposed to look at this now that we're starting to see reports on how bad the traffic may be? Did something fall through? Was there a plan that did not actually come through? Or is this just the inevitable result of putting a large baseball stadium into a suburban area?
Yeah, I think that traffic has been a major concern with this project really since it was announced. And I think, if anything, maybe the people fretting over it is getting more and more as, the opening of the stadium approaches. So maybe you're hearing more of it because of that. But I remember the very first public meetings on this thing, traffic was front and center concern from right out of the gate.
So, Angie, is there also concern, do you think, that people may avoid the stadium if traffic is really bad? I mean, if you're stuck in traffic for, over an hour just getting from the interstate to the stadium, I would imagine that would turn down ticket sales.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, I think that's possible. It will be interesting to see, like I said. It will be interesting. Potentially. I mean, I think maybe traffic already might be sort of a deterrent, even without considering the additional cars.
That is blogger Angie Schmidt, and we spoke with AJC reporter Dan Kleppel. We're talking about the new Braves Stadium in Cobb. Angie's the editor of Streets Blog USA. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
SunTrust Park is not the only major stadium project underway in the Atlanta area. It's an exciting time for our local sports franchises, but not everyone is happy about the construction. Don Smith isn't, and he is not shy about sharing his feelings. It's time for the gripe bag.
I don't like things now compared to the way they used to be.
You know what really grinds my gears?
All this progress. Phooey!
Will you please tell me why?
That's the way it was, and we liked it.
Get off my lawn!
Millions of dollars are leached from public coffers to help people who should spend their own money if they want to build a new sports facility. Cobb County is already pouring $400 million of public dollars into the Braves project. They also need to erect a pedestrian bridge over I-285, whose original cost was said to be $9 million more, but has risen. Cobb says it won't be ready in time for the opening, and DOT won't help out. Officials also propose $1 million-plus annually to pay for circulator buses in the area, and many people regard that as taxpayer subsidy for the Braves. If there is money for that, then why are our streets riddled with potholes and plated with steel and our bridges badly needing repair? Then there's transportation. The intersection of I-75 and I-285 may be the worst conceivable place in northern Georgia to situate a stadium people will have to travel to in some sort of transport, private or public, to the county that didn't want MARTA, remember? Maybe the transport problem should be solved before the stadiums are built, and every transaction should be subject to sunshine laws, not brokered in secret, then sprung on the public. Well, we're told it's a matter of civic pride, like getting the Super Bowl. But letting the NFL, a nonprofit organization, remember, not charge sale tax for Super Bowl tickets, is another example of how public money is gleefully thrown away so billionaires and millionaires can keep more of theirs. If the NFL is worried about the high price of tickets, let them reduce them. It seems sadly like a matter of gullibility. How many times has this city been suckered by promises of benefits that will allegedly come flooding in the wake of a new stadium or large public performance venue, only to hear the same song not many years later, when Atlanta Stadium needs to be Olympic Stadium, needs to be SunTrust Park, and Georgia Dome must be replaced by Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and hundreds of millions of public dollars are required to facilitate these ambitions of people who already have most of the money anyhow. So it's a matter of money, much of which could almost certainly be better spent on schools or public transportation, public health, or that woefully needy category known as infrastructure. Sometimes it is better to fix the old things than keep building new ones. But Atlanta is a tear-down town.
Don Smith is a writer and producer for Georgia Public Broadcasting. That's our show for today. I'll bet you have an opinion about traffic, though. That's my bet. Why is it so bad around Atlanta, and will traffic keep you away from the Braves' new stadium? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk or post your response on Facebook. Our show is produced by Sean Powers, Linda Chen, and Taylor Gant. Our interns are Olivia Reingold and Jenna Stafford. Lindsay Foster Thomas is our senior producer. Our engineer is Ryan Thomas. Special thanks to Jacob Boki and Jeff Bonk. Tanya Ott is our vice president of radio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.